and welcome to the final episode of Series 2 of The Good Stuff, a podcast from The Wheel that brings you news, views, and inspiring voices from the Irish non-profit sector. I'm Emily Burke, and we're here again to discuss ways of improving our sector's resilience during the COVID-19 crisis. In this episode, we'll be hearing from two experts in HR and fundraising. Sarah Fagan from Adair Human Resource Management looks at how we can best look after workers' well-being at the moment. And Keith Whelan, aka The Grants Guy, explains how we can make sure our fundraising plans are as robust as possible going into 2021. Again, because of COVID restrictions, we weren't able to speak in person, so all interviews took place online.
My name is Sarah Fagan, and I'm a senior HR and employment law consultant with Adair Human Resource Management. We're one of Ireland's leading expert HR consultancy services, servicing many organisations within the community and voluntary sector, as well as providing consultancy, project work and support to all manner of organisations.
So in terms of what I wanted to talk about today, we've probably got some tough circumstances ahead of us. Organisations might have to make some difficult decisions. Even if they don't, we're operating in a very strange atmosphere that's quite fraught. What would you see as being the major personnel-related challenges ahead of employers?
Yeah, it's a really good question. I think, you know, from the outset of lockdown, a lot of organisations, especially in the community and voluntary sector, were quick to, you know, move to new working practices such as remote working. What we're seeing a lot of now is sort of the unintended consequences that are coming from that, especially as they impact the workforce. And I think one of the main things that needs to be concentrated on or considered by organizations in the community and voluntary sector is an employment engagement type strategy. And the basis of this, or the rationale behind it, is that we're moving from a space where a lot of things were uncertain. Organizations were very agile, they were very resilient, but we're moving into this new space. And it's important that employers are looking at how do we keep the employees that we currently have engaged over the coming months, because unfortunately, COVID-19 hasn't gone away. So we can expect additional changes to come into the workforce. So they really need to focus in on some form of employee engagement strategy that will look at, you know, the communication side, people management, well-being, and even learning and development.
In terms of how they can best support people in creating that engagement strategy, where do you start?
Well, I think that the first or the kind of most important thing is to ensure that you have very frequent, clear and planned communications. We have to come from the sort of space of, you know, a lot of changes have happened and impacts to the workforce, which could have involved pay cuts, layoffs, redundancies. So you have a lot of employees who are, you know, first and foremost trying to maintain that engagement themselves, but also, you know, they could be unclear or uncertain about what their future is within the organization. So communications is really a powerful tool in sort of setting the bar in terms of employment engagement. So, you know, the first thing that we would advise any employer in this kind of situation is to acknowledge and appreciate what the employees have done so far, because it has been a tough road for everyone involved, including the employees. And, you know, a little bit of acknowledgement and appreciation actually goes a long way. It also helps sort of build that trust back with their employer, because after a lot of changes, or even the fact that people were working remotely, you know, and coming from a space where they might have felt isolated or, you know, disengaged, it's really important that you are appreciating the fact that they've grown in, they've really doubled down on flexibility, agility, and they need to sort of get a focus now on where the organization is going over the next 3, 6, 9, or 12 months. So communications is a real good starting point with that. I think the next thing to consider is the fact that at the moment, you know, a lot of organizations still remain in the remote working space, but that is going to change as we return to the workplace. And obviously the government have issued the protocols and there's a number of measures that have to be brought in. But with that and moving back to the workplace comes sort of a stress and anxiety from the employee's point of view, because at the same time, trying to resume normal activity, it's not as easy in this current situation. There has to be a recognition of employers that not everyone will be keen to go back to the workplace keen to, you know, get on public transport again, you know, unsure of what, you know, what the sort of health and safety space is within the organizations. The first thing is communicating what those plans are. So employers need to be sure that, you know, with the COVID-19 response plan, the suspected case response plan, the safety statement, and the well-being of employees is all communicated effectively, because that will help put their minds at ease and it will ensure that their health, safety and welfare is being maintained as they reintroduce themselves to the workplace. I suppose another consideration would be where not every organization is rushing to get back, and because of the litany of measures that they have to action under the protocols, ultimately, you know, for some organizations, they might be in a better space to maintain some form of remote working. So what I've been terming over the last while is a hybrid type of remote working, where you do have employees, you know, still working from home, but they may also be going into the workplace. And with that comes a sort of new sense of people management. There's different requirements. We're no longer in the complete remote working space, but we're no longer in a sort of normal working activity kind of situation. So ultimately, people management has to change. And the only way, you know, to do that effectively is to ensure that you are consistently communicating that there's one message coming from all line managers, and that you're, you know, being transparent with your employees about what is expected of them, you know, how the new kind of work practices will work, and, you know, any unintended consequences that might arise because of this new space.
What's really coming across is the need for communication right now, the need for clear and consistent communication. I feel like one of the challenges is going to be communicating uncertainty in a way that is still useful to employees.
Absolutely. I think, you know, the main thing employers need to consider, you know, when they're sort of trying to communicate in this uncertain time, is that they're only able to do it in a manner that is based on fact. So what do they currently know? Uncertainty could be one of those items. But, you know, they currently know that they have actions to sort of develop or measures to implement under the protocols. Okay, so that's the first thing. And those are mandatory requirements under the Return to Work Safety protocols. So ultimately, you know, communicate that effectively and balance that with the need to be transparent about additional requirements of flexibility. So for example, an organization might think, okay, we need to stagger work times. We need to perhaps have different teams working 1 week on, 1 week off. And that's a way for them to control and measure and mitigate the risk of infection. But at the same time, that might have to change, that it's realized, okay, that's not working for us. So it really is important that employers are transparent that, you know, this is what we intend to do. We don't know if it's going to work. We're asking everyone to be flexible, but there may be changes necessitated. And as soon as those changes come to realization, we will communicate that with you. And that's why it's important, especially as you are in that either remote or hybrid remote working or full return to the workplace, that you are saying to employees, you know, we expect flexibility. We'll return that to you as best we can. But you have to understand that we're dealing with this as best we can, and we will communicate any changes as they arise.
And in terms of planning that kind of hybrid blended style of work, are there any resources or good practice guides for organizations trying to plan this kind of thing at the moment? Because there seem to be, there's a wealth of options as to how to go about it. And for a lot of people who've never had to think about it before, I think it can be a little daunting to try and figure out exactly
how. Absolutely. It is extremely daunting for a lot of organizations. But what you have to remember is that while there are differences in relation to how unintended consequences are coming from COVID-19 for the different organizations, the commonality comes from the protocols. Mm-hmm. So I think in terms of assessing your own workforce and, you know, dealing with those unintended consequences, such as certain employees having underlying health conditions, the basis of action for all employers in that situation is a risk assessment. And that's something that is, you know, common through the protocols. So, you know, certain approaches will be different for dealing with, you know, different employee related issues. But when it comes to the COVID-19 response plan or the suspected case response plan, all organizations really should be on the same page. And the same applies through the return to work form. Like that form has actually, which is a mandatory requirement, obviously, but that form has been developed to basically allow employers to get an insight into any, you know, issues that might arise or that might be relevant to a person returning to the workplace. And that will then, you know, allow them to consider, okay, how do we best approach this? So it's really important that all employers are looking at the risk assessments relevant to COVID-19 and relevant to their specific functions within their operations.
Are there any other really common emergent questions that you've been dealing with recently?
Well, I think when it comes to employees and the fact that the protocols, you know, has listed mandatory actions that every employer and every organization needs to be compliant with, especially as the Health and Safety Authority, you know, can send out inspectors and issue improvement notices and so forth. A lot of organizations are asking, you know, how do we support the mental health and well-being of employees? You know, this is something that is extremely important. And I suppose the silver lining, if you want to look at it in that way, you know, of the impact of COVID-19 is that this is now front and center. Like, it, you know, we've seen over the last number of years, it's, you know, mental health issues have had a more prominent place in the media and so forth. But ultimately, it's a positive thing that it's sort of been brought to the fore again, because it means that employers are now taking their obligations, their legal obligations under the Safety, Health and Welfare Work Act as seriously when it comes to mental health and well-being. The difficulty is that, you know, sometimes it's hard to sort of ascertain what kind of tangible actions can I put in place to support employees, you know, when they have mental health challenges or concerns. The first thing that, you know, I would say, and I think a lot of organizations are already doing it, is to ensure that you have the proper resources, so the proper information available to employees so that they can get help and support where needed. Now, one thing that has come from COVID-19 is that there's a lot of free available resources online that organizations can avail of in terms of mental health and well-being, in terms of, you know, focusing on fitness challenges and, you know, different things that could be brought into the workplace in this new norm, so that there's a greater focus on it. And to be honest, when you are focusing on mental health and well-being, employees are more satisfied and therefore they're more engaged and they feel valued within the organization, because that's an aspect that, you know, a lot of organizations probably didn't focus on in its entirety previously. So it's really important that it's coming to the fore and that it's been actioned again. But other items that sort of could be actioned by organizations in the support of mental health and well-being would be to provide an employee assistance program. Now, obviously, there is always associated costs with this. And, you know, in the community and voluntary sector, I'm conscious that there would be restraint on, you know, funding and so forth. And they have been impacted, obviously, you know, because of the pandemic. But, you know, there are, as I said, free resources out there. And the Health Service Executive, I believe, have launched a free phone employee assistance program type support. And that is available, you know, to all organizations. But the other thing is that, you know, it's not always like about the positive. It's also about dealing with the challenging issues that arise in mental health and well-being. You know, some employees will be moving from complete isolation, and, you know, there will be a lot of fear and anxiety and stress in returning to the workplace because, you know, because of the restrictions, they may have, you know, been living alone and so forth. So it's important that employers are recognizing where support is needed. So, you know, ensure line managers are having regular one-to-ones. If anyone has concerns, be empathetic, listen to them, see what you could do together, you know, to support that person or that individual employee, but also know and recognize when you need to have external assistance, such as a referral to an occupational health physician. It would be, I suppose, remiss of me if I didn't mention the fact that the Safety, Health and Welfare at Work Act 2005 places a legal obligation on employers to maintain health, safety and welfare of employees. And that's where the mental health and well-being comes into place. So if you have an employee who's been particularly challenged throughout the last number of months, make sure that as an organisation, you are referring to occupational health to understand what supports the organisation needs to put in place to maintain the health, safety and welfare of that employee.
Do you have a final message or a final piece of advice to organisations at the moment?
I have to commend a lot of organisations. They really have shown an enormous amount of resilience and agility. But we have to remember that we're moving into this new normal and organisations need to future-proof their organisations. So that means looking at the workforce, implementing planning strategies, employment engagement strategies, but also trying to retain employees that, you know, remain on within their organisation. So I really would recommend that consistent and clear messaging is front and centre. I think that there should be, you know, maybe not a financial investment, but an investment nonetheless in learning and development. So try and invest in upskilling your employees. They will be more confident in facing challenges. It means that they will feel valued within the organization. They will be engaged within the organization. And you can start building up a new way of working. And basically, you know, trying to instill and promote the culture that organizations have worked so hard on over the last number of years.
Well, great. Thank you so much, Sarah. Thank you for your time.
No problem. Thank you for having me, Emily.
Moving on from the topic of HR to fundraising, I spoke with Keith, who was kind enough to join us all the way from Australia.
My name is Keith Whelan, and I operate a grants consultancy in both Ireland and Australia, where I'm based. And we help not-for-profits, charities, community organisations, sporting groups and the like with grants, with crowdfunding, with fundraising, with sponsorship, anything about financials, where they are, where they need to be in terms of their business processes. So it's quite wide and varied what I do, but quintessentially it's about grants.
So obviously a big concern for lots of organisations at the moment is the continuity of finances. I guess I invited you broadly to talk about the idea of resilience at that kind of organisational level. So to start on the broadest terms, what do you think resilience means at an organisational level? And how can it be built up, especially in the current climate?
I think resilience means policies, procedures and personnel. They're all in order, they're all in line, you're up to date. They're effective and efficient and flexible at the same time. So what we didn't see even pre-COVID-19, necessarily from the NGO and not-for-profit sector, and not as an indictment in Ireland, because we've seen the same in Australia and New Zealand, where I work as well, is this lack of financial preparation or lack of financial insight into what we should be doing necessarily, particularly around the smaller charities and community organisations, not necessarily the larger ones. So forward planning, forward thinking, that's what I've seen a lack of. And I think if anything now, COVID-19 has given us a reboot as an organization to look at where we are and where we need to be as an organization from board level down. And that's through governance, best practice, policies, procedures, and look at your resilience and risk mitigation strategies really and what you should be implementing across the board. So for me now, it's just two words. I think everyone's banding around and using them, Emily, which is consolidate and pivot. Okay, so definitely consolidate now, look at what you have and what you need without basically looking at drastic cost-cutting measures and then pivoting, slightly turning your modus operandi as an organization into having that flexibility of approach and adapting accordingly to what the sector is throwing at you now and where you really need to be in 6 months. Because I think when essentially there's budgets there to supplant and from government and from funding bodies to help organizations, but that might necessarily be the same in 2021. So I think now is to look at your business plan, look at your project plans, look at your strat plan, and look at your budgets, and certainly work with your bookkeeper, your accountant, or your chief financial officer to consolidate and do that as well. It's not about, like, you know, I think we've gone past the stage now of being, you know, running around and being scared about what happened. I think we've seen a transition in the past couple of weeks and months, which has been great. But resilience for me, quintessentially, means having a planned, tactile approach all the time, every time.
Okay, so that leads me very nicely into my next question, which is, you know, you're saying a planned approach. for me, outside of the world of financial planning, that's a lot of words you just threw at me. For organizations who are in a position of having to reassess their organizational plans and are taking a step back to look at their finances, what would you be prioritizing right now in terms of what needs to be done first?
I think one of the first things we need to look at really is, cutting with precision at the end of the day. There's a lot of cost cutting going on at the present time, particularly for smaller organizations. You cut too deep and your business will never recover. So I think you need to, you're looking at your cash flow problems at the present time, make a shallow cut and look at basically where you need to be in terms of that, in terms of the unemployment line. But exercise care, caution and judgment in determining what you need to do and where you need to cut and by how much, basically, and really look inside your organization to do that. And that really comes back to what I was saying about pivoting at the end of the day. And again, that comes back to basics of undertaking a SWOT analysis, your strengths, your weaknesses, your opportunities, your threats, understanding where you are in your marketplace at the present time. And then your four Ps, your product, place, promotion as well. Just simple formulaic strategies or even doing a mind map of really where you are and then all everything around you and what's associated with you as well at the same time. So take a step back, I think, take a deep breath and have a plan. So what's going to get you out of this is templates and planning, all right? And really that's the first thing you need to do is sit down and go, have we got a plan? If we have, we need to rejuvenate it because it's not the same plan pre-COVID and it needs to look at a practical implementation of that plan. So you're going to look at streamlining that plan and how you can make it user-friendly. A lot of plans that I see, Emily, in a not-for-profit and community sector are very good in theoretical, not very good in practice. So I think now is the time to look at that transition for your plan to make sure you can implement what you've set out to achieve. So that's the planning stage, definitely. And I think everything then falls in after that if you have a plan. And that comes back to those templates at the end of the day, which is, risk management template, risk mitigation strategy, as I said, employment, basically, everything there. Have a plan. And that's what I haven't seen, as I said, pre-COVID, let alone necessarily post-COVID to a degree. The only way you're going to get out of this is by planning your way out of this. And that means looking at consolidating. So you can't do this on your own. You bring your senior management team or your board, and then bring in your bookkeeper, your accountant, as I said, your marketing and comms person as well, because you need to profile build. Okay, so now is the time. Consolidation is one thing. So planning, consolidation, and then really marketing yourself. So let's talk about it in terms of the three R's. Okay, research where you are and where you need to be. Relationship, about what relationships now you need to have internally and externally to move forward. And then reporting, what reporting you need to do to get you through this, basically, what mandatory documentation, what backfill you need to have, that gap analysis, per se, of your company or your organization that you never had the chance before because you were time poor. Now, if anything, COVID has allowed us to have this epiphany moment, an awakening to what we should have been doing 6 months, 6 years ago. The three R's are really another process I would go through in terms of planning again. And to reiterate them again, I would look at, obviously, research, relationship and reporting.
And as you mentioned that you've encountered issues with planning, are there particular stumbling blocks for community and voluntary organizations when it comes to planning that you see maybe running through as a thread?
Time and capacity, quintessentially, Emily, to be honest with you. Just time to do it, capacity to deliver it, because they're under-resourced, underutilized, they're a volunteer-based organization. How far can you stretch people, basically, in time limitations? Logistics, resources, all of those things which are always there, but now is an expectation because the bar has truly and firmly been raised for the not-for-profit and NGO sector worldwide. And in terms of, it's not even, you're not a not-for-profit even anymore. It's now profit for purpose is the correct terminology. So you really need to think about where you are and where you need to be. So again, you need to look at really utilizing time and capacity. I see that as the biggest issue all the time. You really need to sit down and streamline your processes now. So lean management processes will help you. Critical thinking processes will help you. Understanding that you may need to bring in a mentor or business coach in some degree as well, basically, or people that are industry proficient in the facets of the services that you need to develop, let alone enhance. So whether that's from a financial standpoint, a marketing standpoint, a business development standpoint, now's the time to, you're not just community mindset anymore, you're community mindset in terms of delivery, but don't be seen as an ad hoc voluntary in the way you do service delivery. Now's the time to become professional because unfortunately, Emily, what we're going to see is a natural attrition rate in the sector. So we're going to see a fall off of some community organizations, some charities, not-for-profits. That's a given. It's just going to happen. Some are not going to survive, unfortunately. And I don't want to be the doomsayer, but that's just a practical thing that's going to happen. So for surviving, you need to look at, right, where we are and where we need to be. Do we need to look at consolidation? Do we need to look at absorption into a bigger organization at the end of the day? Do we need to look at being part of a conglomerate or a consortium, basically, or a greater community social enterprise? for instance, that could be in existence, particularly in regional and rural areas, which are going to be affected even more than metro areas in Ireland. So, you know, these resources, we can't allow them to dissipate, particularly in regional and rural areas, which need them even as much as metro areas. So you need to look at consolidation. You need to look at partnering. You need to look at what they call community capacity building now more than ever before, which I think is partnering or being auspiced by other organizations through a lot of your programs or endeavors. That will come with mindset. So time and capacity is one thing. Mindset, it's, you know, you have to change the way you do things, and that's changing the way you're thinking as an organization. And that can be hard because a lot of organizations that I deal with in Ireland and Australia, if it ain't broke, we don't fix it. You know, if it's, we're stuck in 1955 because it was a great year because it was the year we set up. And that's great, but it's not 1955 anymore. And it's certainly not even 2020 as we once knew it as well. So it's now time to really think about plan, how you to develop and deliver on those plans and implement those plans. So it's really theoretical and practical, if you want to break it down to two categories. And all I see all the time, and what I'm trying to get my clients across the mindset of, is great that you formalize the approach and you're theoretical and you come up with a plan and you designed it. How do we implement it for a greater effect? And that's the two-stage process that I would advocate.
And are there particular strategies around, because obviously planning at the moment comes with a greater deal of uncertainty than usual. Will we still be operating as usual in 6 months? Will there be a lockdown again in the meantime? Will we have to go back to online service delivery? There are a lot of questions that come up. Are there particular risk management strategies that you would be advocating using at the moment?
Look, number one, have a risk management plan. I think that's the first thing, to be honest with you. The fact that I don't see that in the first instance, let alone recommending a strategy, says a lot about the sector as a whole. So have a risk management plan. It seems to go above people's heads when I say you should have one, because it's nearly mandatory expectation from a government department or government entity that if I'm going to utilize your services or you're seeking funding from me, why would you not have a risk management plan, identify perceivable risks that are there? To highlight one, there's many different numerous templates on the web you can source, basically. So I'm not necessarily going to advocate one. I just firmly believe you need one. So whatever you think is adaptable and best fit for your organization at the end of the day, to have one is what you're going to do. So go through the myriad of what's out there, find what's best fit for yourself at the end of the day, and implement one. It doesn't have to be bigger than Ben-Hur. It's a user-friendly document. So at the end of the day, I'm talking about a risk management plan that's 10 to 20 pages at most, even if that, because it needs to be a living, breathing document that you refer to every single day, like your business plan. So the risk management strategies, A, have the mindset that you're going to incorporate that, identify what risks are, highlight what are, and then your mitigation of how you're going to combat them or perceivable what they are. You make a very good point, though. It's a very fluid society we live in at the moment, and it changes day by day, week by week. So how do you have that flexibility of approach? Well, you need to look at a staged approach to your implementation of your planning and contingency strategies as well, because obviously, as you rightly said, you could plan for next week and it could turn on its head. So I think you need to have that flexibility in your modeling, that when you are sitting down to do your risk mitigation plan or risk management plan, you need to factor in all the contingencies that potentially could happen, potentially as best you can. But needless to say, if you're doing a risk management plan outside of COVID-19 or pre-COVID-19, that was the expectation anyway. To best your ability, you would envisage or foresee potential problems in your sector, potential problems in your service delivery, potential problems in your logistics or resources, or you as an organization. I'm just asking you to do that and mitigate and mediate as best you can. So what I'm recommending to my clients at the moment is at least do a risk management plan or a strat plan or a business plan for at least 6 to 12 months. That's it. Don't be doing your 3 and 5 year plans, because I think we're so far down the road from that yet. Just for a lot of hallmarks now we're looking at is end of 2020, do a plan until the end of 2020, and then really up till June 2021, if you really want to go that further as well. So the year optimally and work back. But really, for a lot of people, it's really getting to the end of the year, because it's just changing so fluid basically across the world. So it's really consolidating. And now everyone's just thinking about the finance when I say consolidate, or when I talk about risk management, it's all about money. Of course, that's the common denominator here, without doubt. It's about survivability. It's about finding the capital to get through these difficult times. But there's other ways you need to look at that and to ascertain funding for survivability and sustainability, which is, as I said previously, increasing your profile that if people know that you exist, they can give you funding. So your marketing and comms are going to be quintessential here, that people can back you and believe you're still in existence and what you do is fundamental, and they can give you funding for that, whether it be public or private sector. So take a staged approach, do it over 6 to 12 months, take it basically and look at the practicality of delivering that over 6 to 12 months basically, and factor in as much as you can in the remit of what we're living in, the times that we are living in, the contingencies that are going to happen.
Have you got any final message of advice or encouragement for people at the moment?
Just the KISS principle, keep it simple. You know, don't overtly complicate. I think we're all grabbing basically now for best practice models and trying to duplicate what everyone else is doing. Basically, do what's best fit for your organization. Factor in the time and capacity necessary to do that. Take a breath and be objective and look at really where you are and where you need to be, basically. But do a baby step approach and, you know, really look categorically at what needs to happen over the 6 months. And don't be afraid to make decisions at the end of the day, because it could mean surviving. It could mean sustainability. And it could mean, most importantly, a better organization, because you'll end up being version 2.0 of yourself. So I have great hope and optimism for the sector. I think there's a lot of great people doing great things out there across the board, and learn from them, but utilize, don't plagiarize, and look at your own organization first and foremost.
Great. Thanks so much, Keith. Thanks for taking the time to be with us.
Thank you, Emily.
Thanks again to both of our guests for their contributions. If you'd like to know more about any of the topics we've discussed, know that we at The Wheel regularly run workshops on fundraising and HR, among many other things. Take a look at wheel.ie/training for information on upcoming sessions. As always, we love to hear your comments, questions, and ideas for future podcast guests. You can find The Wheel on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at @the_wheel_IRL, or email me at emily@wheel.ie. That's it for season 2 of the show, but if you've enjoyed these episodes, be sure to subscribe, as we'll be back soon with even more. Thank you so much for listening, and take care.